But to give you the spirit of the founder and the spirit that gave the impetus to Islam to conquer the entirety of Western Asia, the entirety of Northern Africa, and to begin to conquer Europe, you need to hear this from the Quran. This is Quran Surah 8 and verse 40. Know that whatever booty you take, the fifth of it is God's, and the messengers, and the near kinsmen, and the orphans, and for the needy, and the traveler. So they give a kind of a double tithe on what's taken there. And then here is from Surah 47, verses 4 and 8. When you meet the unbelievers, smite their necks. Then when you have made wide slaughter among them, tie fast the bonds, then set them free either by grace or ransom till the war lays down its loads. So it shall be. And if God had willed, he would have avenged himself upon them, but that he may try some of you by means of others. And those who are slain in the way of God, he will not send their works astray. And listen to this very carefully. He will guide them and dispose their minds aright, and he will admit them to paradise that he has made known to them. This is very important. When I had the local Muslim leader, Sheikh Yasser Muhammad, come here in the sanctuary 6 or so weeks ago and talk to my high school Bible class, I had planted a question with one of the students from last year who was visiting from college to ask him, how can I know I'm going to go to heaven? And what was the response of Sheikh Yasser Muhammad? Well, you can't know that. Why? Well, you can't know that you've really satisfied the will of Allah, that you've been good enough in order for Allah to admit you to heaven. In other words, it's works righteousness, but you can never know that you've been good enough. But look at here. You want to know the John 3:16 of the Quran? Our John 3:16 tells us what? In spite of the fact that you and I are both moral failures and have deep character flaws and fall short of the glory of God, we have John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. What's their John 3:16? Let me read it for you again. And here it is, their John 3:16. What's the one way you can know you're going to go to heaven in Islam? Here it is. And those who are slain in the way of God, he will not send their works astray. He will guide them and dispose their minds aright, and he will admit them to paradise that he has made known to them. Surah 4, verse 75 of the Quran. So let them fight in the way of God, who sell the present life for the world to come. And whoever fights in the way of God and is slain or conquers, we shall bring him a mighty wage. Surah 9, verse 110. God has bought from the believers their selves and their possessions against the gift of paradise. They fight in the way of God. They kill and are killed. That is a promise binding upon God in the Torah and the Gospel and the Quran. See, notice they recognize the holy books of Judaism and Christianity, but he goes on. And who fulfills his covenant truer than God? We read further. This is from Quran, Surah 44, verse 52. Surely the God-fearing shall be in a station secure among gardens and fountains, robed in silk and brocade, set face to face. Even so, and we shall espouse them to wide-eyed houris, therein calling for every fruit secure. What is a houri? A houri is a virgin. She may not be a human virgin. And this is a very important thing we have to say about Islam in terms of the status of women. Can a woman go to heaven? We don't know. Well, what about the women who are in heaven, the houris? We don't know whether they're really human or whether they were simply created by Allah for the sexual pleasure of men. So how can you know you're going to go to heaven? Well, you can try to be good enough. And Muslims do try to live a kind of self-righteous way. And there are very many fine Muslim people. And not all Muslims are terrorists. I want to make that plain. We should befriend the Muslims who have come to our community. We should try to establish a friendship so that we build a bridge so that we can share our faith in Christ, which you have to do very slowly, very gradually. But make no mistake about it. You can't know you're going to go to heaven in Christianity except by one way, the John 3:16 way. And you can't know you're going to go to heaven in Islam, but one way, and that's the way of jihad. Now, what happens when you retreat before an enemy unless it's a strategic move? You know, sometimes you retreat, pull back so that you can gain an advantage on an enemy and move in for the attack. What happens there? You want to know how to go to hell? Not pass go, not collect $200. Here is Surah 8, verse 15. O believers, when you encounter the unbelievers marching to battle, turn not your backs to them. Whoso turns his back that day to them, unless withdrawing to fight again or removing to join another host, he is laden with the burden of God's anger, and his refuge is Gehenna, an evil homecoming. So you want to know how to go to hell? You surrender. Surrender in battle. It's a sure ticket to hell. Now, what happens in with Islam? We talked about the Battle of Tours, 732. The Islamic forces are held in check in Western Europe by Charles Martel. We talk about the Battle of Vienna, where Eastern Europe is saved from the Muslim hordes in 1683. Islam kind of goes into a period of decline. Not absolutely, but decline in terms of trying to conquer the West. And it kind of sits on its laurels and holds its own. And it's ruled by and large by the Ottoman Empire. Now, the Ottomans line up with the Austrians and the Germans in World War I. And, of course, they're defeated. And then two things happen that create lots of the problems we have today. One of the things that happens is with the defeat of the Ottoman Empire and its collapse, an English general by the name of General Allenby takes on the task of dividing up the Middle East. So he takes these lands that were controlled by the caliph there in Baghdad, I guess, or Constantinople. I'm not sure where he ruled from, but the Ottoman Empire, got that fuzzy, sorry. These lands that were controlled by the Ottoman Empire now are separate countries. They're Muslim countries. And the British, having won the war, begin to divide the thing up. Sometimes it was a very natural division. Iraq was a very unnatural division. Why was Iraq an unnatural division? Well, in terms of culture and people groups, there is next to Iran, that part of Iraq that's next to Iran, is largely a Shiite community. Remember that the vast majority, about 90% of Muslims, are Sunnis, but about 10% are Shiites. The Shiites are the dominant group in Iran, but they're also the dominant people group in Iraq, except around Baghdad. And around Baghdad, there is a sizable minority of Sunnis. And then up to the north, there are the Kurds. And so what happens is General Allenby takes his cookie cutter out, and he's got this rolled out dough, the old Ottoman Empire, and he says, well, let's see, we'll call this Jordan. Now, we do know historically about Syria, but we'll create Jordan, and we'll call this something else, and this something else. And I'm being a little bit hyperbolic here, but sometimes it was really an arbitrary thing. There was a second thing that created some of our tensions, and that was the Balfour Declaration that takes place in the wake of World War I. And the Balfour Declaration is the espousal of what we call Zionism. And remember, not all Jewish people are Zionists, but a majority of Jewish people are Zionists. And with Zionism is the idea that the Jewish people should find a home away from the diaspora that they've been part of for almost 2,000 years, having been set out into the world, to return to a home of their own. And so with that is the idea of a Jewish homeland. Now, these two forces together, the cookie cutter that General Allenby did, dividing up the former Ottoman Empire, sometimes arbitrarily, finding British-friendly families and say, oh, you're the king of this country, because they were friendly to the British. And then the Balfour Declaration, with the beginning of Zionism and the immigration of lots of Jewish people, begins to set things into trouble. Because then you begin to have clashes with various ethnic groups. And remember that these people have been held in check by what? By an iron will, just as Marshal Tito, after World War II, seizes power in Yugoslavia and rules these various ethnic groups with an iron boot. So the Ottomans had ruled these people and held a lot of forces in check. But now the cookie cutter comes in from the British. Now there's the beginning of the emigration of Jews. And with World War II and the Holocaust that Adolf Hitler committed against the Jews, there's an enormous sympathy, an enormous impetus to give the Jewish people a state of their own. And so what happens on May 18th, 1948 is there's a war for independence and the Jewish state is established. But immediately what happens? The entirety of the Middle East comes against that. And so the entirety of the Arab world is against the state of Israel for a lot of reasons. The enormous antipathy of the Muslim world against Jews really begins at this point. I'm not saying there wasn't resentment against Jews before that, but I'm talking about the enormous antipathy against Jews begins at this point. Because they see the Jews as having taken the third holiest place in Islam. See, what's the holiest place in Islam? Mecca. What's the second holiest place? Medina. What's the third holiest place? Jerusalem, in Islamic teaching. And so you have two great mosques there on the site of the Jewish temple. And so now there's this great conflict. And so there is a native Arab, largely Muslim population that is driven from their homes, being replaced by a Jewish population that's not Middle Eastern in its basic thinking at all, but European. So these Jewish people come from particularly Russia and Eastern Europe and other parts of the world, and they begin to immigrate into Israel. And what's the result? Arab Muslims are driven from their own homes and put into detention centers or forced to live in other communities. So there you are. You're a Muslim Arab. Your father farmed this land. He worked the olive trees. Those same olive trees were around when your granddaddy was there, your great-granddaddy, and there's a tradition that goes back 10 generations that the Khalid family has owned this farm and worked it for at least 10 generations. And now a bunch of Europeans who dress like prostitutes, because Islam is extremely modest. In Islam, a woman can only uncover her hands and her face. She can't uncover her arms. She can't uncover her legs. So a woman in shorts looks like a harlot. So now a group of loose-living, virtual atheists, immoral people have come in and they've taken your homeland, and they are now farming your land that was your daddy's and your granddaddy's for 10 generations. And how do you think they feel? So one of the things that happens is you have these Palestinians wanting to go to other countries, and they're not wanted. You think they're wanted in Jordan? You think they're wanted in Syria? You think they're wanted in Kuwait? They work in Kuwait, but they have no rights. They're an oppressed minority, even in Kuwait. So you've got these two factors. You've got the cookie-cutter approach of General Allenby, and you've got the rise of the state of Israel. Now, there are two developments that you need to get a hold of if you want to understand Islam in the modern world. And these are phenomena that occur in the 20th century. There's never been in Islam what happened in the West with the Enlightenment. In the Enlightenment, we had the concept of what? Religious freedom. You can be a Catholic, you can be a Baptist, you can be a Jew, you can be a Lutheran, you can be an Episcopalian, you can be a Pentecostal, it's okay. Just don't go destroy anything, don't violate the laws, don't force your religion in some kind of physical way on somebody else, and you're free to practice it. You can be a Mormon. And you can practice spiritual polygamy, but you can't practice literal polygamy. In other words, it's not absolute freedom of religion in America, but it's freedom of religion up to the point of not breaking the law. So you're free to be a Mormon. You're free to be a Jehovah's Witness. You're free, if you feel like your conscience won't allow you to stand and salute the flag, you're free not to do that out of religious reasons, as Jehovah's Witnesses have done. So in other words, there's a basic religious freedom that grows out of the Enlightenment, but the Muslim world has never experienced that. And in the Muslim world, there's no difference between a pronouncement of a recognized religious leader, like a preacher, and the president of a country or a congress of a country passing a law and saying this is the case. And this you've got to understand. In Islam, If I happen to be an imam, a religious leader, a recognized religious leader, so, you know, if I were a Muslim, that's what I would be, and I determine that Don Sproul has written something that blasphemes the Prophet Muhammad, I can issue what's called a fatwa on Don Sproul. Need to understand this. Don Sproul can live in Paris, France, and I can live in Istanbul, okay? And I have that authority to issue a fatwa on the head of Don Sproul because I've read a book that Don Sproul has written, and it offends, it blasphemes the Prophet. Now, what you need to understand is that in the Islamic way of thinking, for me as a religious leader to issue that fatwa for his death, calling for his death, is absolutely of the same legal force as if the Ninth Judicial District Court here in Louisiana met, and a judge of the Ninth Judicial District Court held court, and a jury of a man's peers tried and found a man guilty of first-degree murder, did the second trial to determine the penalty, which would be death, and that Ninth Judicial District judge has that convicted murderer stand before him and says, I sentence you, Hambarm, to death by lethal injection. And what you need to understand is that for me as a religious leader, to say that there's a fatwa on the head of Don Sproul living 10 countries away because he blasphemed the Prophet is of the same force legally as a jury of your peers finding you guilty of murder, tried before the judge, and the judge pronouncing the death penalty on you. That's really serious and a basic difference. Now, there were forces that began to arise in the 20th century within Islam to secularize Islam a little bit. Now, this is what many Americans fail to come to grips with. The first and greatest of those leaders is a man by the name of Kemal Ataturk. Ataturk helped to take the core piece in the old Ottoman Empire and begin to westernize some of it, begin to make it a little more secular, a little looser, a little more tolerant. But what you need to understand is that the big leader of this thing in the post-World War II world is a man by the name of Abdel Nasser. He's an Egyptian. And he led a movement called Pan-Arabism. And his goal was to unite the entire Muslim world into one big nation. And would have been, relatively speaking, secularistic. Now, when I say secularistic, it's kind of like Jimmy Carter in Christianity. Jimmy Carter a Christian? Sure. Many people said he's the best ex-president we ever had. But Jimmy Carter represented a kind of secular approach to Christianity. Jimmy Carter, take like abortion. Jimmy Carter would be personally opposed to abortion. He would never have an abortion. Of course, he'd never need one. But he would not do anything to restrict a woman's access to abortion. So when I'm talking about secularism, that's an analogy there. In other words, it's distancing a little bit of the religious conviction from everyday life. Well, Nasser represents in a mild way that. Now, here's the deal with Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein is a member, I guess, of the Ba'athist Party. The Ba'athist Party was a relatively speaking secularist movement. That's why, interestingly enough, you remember the guy that we learned to hate for the last 10 years who'd get on TV? Tariq Aziz. Tariq Aziz is a Christian. He's, well, ain't a real Christian. Well, hey, I don't know who a real Christian is or not. I know I'm a Christian. I know I've been to Jesus and I'm born again and I'm going to heaven. I'm not going to evaluate whether a person's a real Christian or not. There are contradictions in his life, obviously. But the only man I have to worry about is, am I a Christian? He was a professing Christian, a member of a Christian church. Well, you wouldn't have that in what? Saudi Arabia. You wouldn't have that in Saudi Arabia. You wouldn't have that in most Muslim countries. But you would have that in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, because Saddam Hussein was not an Islamicist. He espoused Islam, but he was not an Islamicist. What do I mean by an Islamicist? Well, I want to introduce you to the philosopher behind Osama bin Laden. In the year 1966, Abdel Nasser hung a man. And that man's name is Saeed Qutb. Saeed Qutb. Saeed Qutb is an Egyptian who wanted to take us back to the original teachings of Muhammad, Islam in its pure form, Islam as a militant religion, Islam as a religion of conquest, Islam where women didn't run around half-naked, like every woman here tonight is half-naked in a Muslim view of things, because I can see your, at least your forearms. In most cases, now, Nelda, you probably pass, except for your hair, Nelda. That's pretty loose living there for that. For you. That's right. If you wore the scarf, you'd pass. So Saeed Qutb was a professor of philosophy, and he began to gather disciples around him. This is the rise of the modern Islamicist movement. What do you have here? This is very important as we look at the war in the Gulf. Got to remember that, once again, I can declare a fatwa on Don Sproul. He lives in Paris, France, and I live in Istanbul, and it's absolutely recognized. Just as much as if a jury in the Ninth Judicial District, with a judge of that district court, issues the death penalty after a proper trial for murder. You have to understand that Islamicism is a religious political movement within Islam that is extremely strong. Why is it strong? Does that mean that all Islamicists are terrorists? No. But it does mean that all Islamicists believe strongly in Islamic militancy, believe in eventually forcing the West to prostrate itself. What's their great beef with the West? Here's their beef with the West. The beef of those, why do they bomb us? You want to know why they hate us? Here they are. How do I know this? Because they make no secret about it. You want to read about it? Go to my website, and I have Osama bin Laden's Epistle of War. He spells out why he's waging war against us. Number one reason, our presence in their holy land. 1943, middle of World War II, in order to secure the newly discovered oil fields of Arabia, Franklin Roosevelt places American troops there. We've maintained a military presence in Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Muslim world in one way or another since 1943. The big boot in this was in the first Gulf War. The Saudi Arabians, their oil fields are threatened because Saddam Hussein comes down and takes Kuwait. They turn to us for help. We provide the help. Who offered to defend that country? Osama bin Laden. Who was Osama bin Laden? He was our creation, just as Saddam Hussein was our creation. Ronald Reagan created Saddam Hussein in a certain sense, because to get back at Iran, after Iran had humiliated us under Jimmy Carter and seizing our embassy, we wanted to build up militarily the biggest threat to Iran, which was Iraq. And you know, those people were fighting each other. And we trained Saddam and his army and his secret police and gave him lots of military materiel in order for him to wage war. He's Ronald Reagan's man. What about Osama bin Laden? Well, we saw a great opportunity in fighting the Cold War as the Russians were trying to back the puppet regime in a place called Afghanistan. And as the Russians are trying to defeat a or to maintain their puppet their stronghold there with a puppet regime in Afghanistan, the United States backed the forces that we call the Mujahideen. Who are the Mujahideen? That's simply holy warriors in a Muslim thing. They were holy warriors, the Mujahideen. Where did the Mujahideen come from? The Mujahideen came from Egypt. The Mujahideen came from Kuwait. The Mujahideen came from Saudi Arabia. They came from Yemen. And one of those people was the son of a very wealthy construction man named Osama bin Laden. And he was trained by our people. And so in a sense, these two forces trained by us, the one a secularist, Saddam Hussein, the other an Islamicist, Osama bin Laden. So there's great offense when we begin to put military people in the Saudi Arabian Peninsula in mass in the first Gulf War. Deeply offended many Muslims, even though the leadership understood that they needed the American military in order to push Saddam Hussein back out of Kuwait. That's area number one of offense, is our being involved there. Let me say something. We have a clear example in the case of Iran of how westernization forced does not work on an Islamic population. What happens? Once again, we back a puppet leader, the Shah of Iran. And what happens? He rules and he tries to westernize. Iran, at the height of the power of the Shah, was one of the most, quote-unquote, democratic countries in the Middle East. A lot of religious toleration, a lot of freedom for women, all of that. But what happens? It's ruled from the top down. And here's the point. We haven't dealt with the underlying spirit of Islam. What we have is the Shah of Iran with his secret police and his reign of terror against anyone who opposes him. So people like the Ayatollah Khomeini have to leave, and he goes to France. Then the Shah develops cancer. The Rockefeller family, who backed him very much, brings him to America. And what happens? In the wake of that, the Ayatollah Khomeini returns home, and the Iranian Revolution occurs. You see, you haven't dealt with the spirit of Islam. Until you deal with the spirit of Islam, all you can do is temporarily suppress it. But the moment that suppression is removed, like a Marshal Tito, the moment that suppression is removed, like Saddam Hussein being removed, then these factions rise to power who are hell-bent on domination of the non-Muslim. So you have the military factor, the West involvement. What's the second big factor? It's huge. The United States supports the state of Israel. That is the second and a huge, huge factor in the hatred of the Muslim world for the United States. Does the Muslim world hate the United States? Kind of like a kid views an abusive dad. It's a love-hate relationship. They love many things about America. They love a lot of things about American culture. They love the economic opportunities of America. But they hate our unconditional support of Israel. No other nation in the world unconditionally supports the modern state of Israel. And the modern state of Israel, under the Likud party, has practiced in a kind and gentle way a kind of genocide on the Palestinians. And I say a kind and gentle way, what I mean by that is they're forced with suicide bombers to push restrictions back more and more. And as they push those restrictions in place, people find less and less opportunity to make a living. If I were the head of Israel, would I do differently? I'm not saying I would do differently. I'm not saying that they're out to do evil. I'm simply saying, if you were faced with going to the market and you've got a woman who looks like she's pregnant, but instead of being pregnant, under her robe is a bomb, and she is willing to blow herself up in order to kill you and 25 other people, what do you do? So I want us to put it in perspective, but you got to understand how it's viewed by the Muslim population. Third thing, why do they hate us? They hate us because America is involved in a secular crusade against Islam. What do I mean by a secular crusade? I'm not talking about something militarily now. I'm talking about our modern hedonistic culture. I'm talking about rock music and the sexual revolution. I'm talking about working through the agencies of the United Nations. Make no mistake about this. If you don't like the UN, know that your friends in Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries hate them even worse. No group of people hates the United Nations as much as the Muslim world. But they see, just as they see Israel as a surrogate of the United States carrying out our will, they see the United Nations as our surrogate, indoctrinating their people in there's nothing wrong with fornication, dress immodestly, it's okay to be a homosexual and all these other things that popular American culture is coming down. Now, there are other factors there. Another factor, a fourth factor, is why do they hate us, is that America has practiced, going back to the Monroe Doctrine to protect the Western Hemisphere, we support bad people as long as they are our friends. In other words, American foreign policy, if we find a dictator over here who's just mean and ornery and oppresses his own people, but he will align himself with us and be an ally with us against our particular enemy, like during the Cold War, the Soviet Union, then we're going to help him out. We're going to train his police forces. We're going to train his military. We're going to send his soldiers to Fort Polk and that kind of thing. So those are four reasons why the Muslim world hates us. The bottom line of what I'm trying to say, and I'll wrap this up with this and open up for questions, is this. I submit to you that Christendom is dying. And Christendom is dying because the church has lost its confidence in the Bible and in biblical Christianity and the biblical way of life to the point that we're not assertive about that in any really effective way, either in Europe, Canada, or the United States. And the United States is... Christianity is still much more vibrant and effective in the United States than it is in Canada, and in Canada than it is in Europe. Islam, on the other hand, is experiencing an enormous revival. And it's been fueled by several forces at once. And I submit that that fueling is because of a demonic power behind Islam. And it's being fueled by several forces. One is economic. Where did Allah put so much of the oil? Right in the middle of them. What's the Muslim world? Is it just Western Asia? What's the biggest Muslim country in the world? Indonesia. The biggest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia. Where is Indonesia? Lots of oil in Indonesia. And it's not in Western Asia, it's in Eastern Asia. They're not Arabs, they're Muslims. So you've got this enormous economic thing. What are Muslims doing today with that money? They're going to poor countries like Egypt and getting poor boys and training them to become sheikhs and imams, and they're sending them to Detroit, Michigan, where they're assimilated and sent out to establish mosques in American cities. What kind of Muslims do you think are being recruited and trained in Islam, and what version of Islam do you think they're being trained in? Generally speaking, not the Shiite 10% minority. It's a 90% Sunni, but it's not just the 90% Sunni. There is a particular sect, just as you can speak of Catholics and Protestants, and within Protestantism, there are various sects. So you can say within Sunni Islam, there are various sects. There's a very strict sect, and it's very much associated with our friend Sayyid Qutb, who was hung by Abdel Nasser. And it's called Wahhabi Islam. Osama bin Laden believes in Wahhabism. He's a Wahhabist. What do you think is the religion of the ruling class of Saudi Arabia? Wahhabism. What kind of Muslims do you think are being recruited, and what version of Islam do you think they're being trained in as they're sent to America? Wahhabism. Islam, the spirit of Islam, is on the ascendancy, it's on the rise, it's a demonic thing, it's powerful, and we is in deep trouble.